This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Hanging Tree by Ben Aronovich. Read for you by Cobbiner Holdbrook-Smith. This book is dedicated to all librarians everywhere, for they are the true keepers of the secret flame and not to be trifled with. Through the streets, our wheels slowly move. The toll of the death bell dismays us. With nosegays and gloves we are decked, so trim and so gay they array us. The passage, all crowded, we see, with maidens that move us with pity. Our air, all admiring, agree, such lads are not left in the city. Oh, then to the tree I must go. The judge, he has ordered the sentence, and then comes a gownsman, you know, and tells a dull tale of repentance. By the gullet we're tied very tight, we beg all spectators pray for us. Our peepers are hid from the light, the tumbrel shoves off, and we Morris. Tyburn Ballad, as transcribed by Francis Place. Chapter 1. One of Sir Roger's Lesser Works. I dreamt that I heard Mr. Punch laughing gleefully by my ear. But when I woke, I realized it was my phone. I recognized the number on the screen and so wasn't surprised by the cool, posh voice that spoke when I answered. "Peter," said Lady Tai, "do you remember when we spoke at Oxford Circus?" I remembered her finding me after I'd managed to get myself buried under the platform. I remembered her leaning over me once they'd dug me out, her breath smelling of nutmeg and saffron. "One day I will ask you for a favor, and do you know what your response will be?" "Yes, ma'am," I said, remembering what I'd said then. "No, ma'am. 3 bags full, ma'am." It was 5 in the morning, still dark, and rain was smattering against the French windows at the far end of Beverly's bedroom. The only serious light came from the screen of my phone. The other half of the big bed was empty. I was alone. "One of my daughter's friends has had an accident," said Lady Di. "I want you to ensure my daughter is not implicated in the subsequent investigation." Oh, shit, I thought. That kind of favor. She gave me the address and what she knew of the circumstances. "You want me to prove your daughter wasn't involved?" I said. "You misunderstand," said Lady Tai. "I don't care what her involvement is. I want her kept out of the case." She really had no idea what she was asking for, but I knew better than to try and explain. "Understood," I said. "And Peter," said Lady Tai, "Nightingale is not to know about this. Is that clear?" "Crystal," I said. As soon as she hung up, I called the folly. "I rather think I'd have to take an interest in any case," said Nightingale once I'd briefed him. "Still, I shall endeavour to adopt a facade of ignorance until such time as you need me." He paused and then said, "And you will let me know when that moment arrives." It was not a question. "Yes, sir," I said, and hung up, wondering why everyone felt the need to be so emphatic at this time of the morning. Beverly owns 2 halves of a 1920s semi-detached house on Beverly Avenue in SW20. It's a strange place, half furnished and underused. Beverly told me when I first visited that she sort of inherited it, and hasn't really decided on what to do with the property yet. She sleeps in a ground floor room with easy access to the back garden. There's just the IKEA bed, with an incomprehensible name, 2 mismatched wardrobes, an antique mahogany chest of drawers, and a Persian carpet that covers half the bare floorboards. I reached out and felt the empty side of the bed. There was just a trace of warmth and a hint of oil on the pillow. Beverly had slipped away hours ago. I sighed, got out from under the warm duvet and shivered. The French windows were half open, letting in a cool breeze and the smell of rain. The bathroom upstairs didn't have a shower, so I had a quick bucket bath in the huge oval tub, which, I knew from happy experience, easily accommodated two people at once, and got dressed. Everything related to operational matters in the Met is monitored, which means you can't just open your Aware terminal and go fishing for information without having a damn good excuse. So while I was buffing up my shoes, I called DC Gulid, who I knew was doing the night shift in the homicide assessment car that week. "Hi, Peter," she said. Behind her, I could hear a hushed indoor ambiance and people being professional. I asked whether she'd heard of a shout in Knightsbridge, a suspicious drug-related death.
"Why do you want to know?"
asked Gulid, which I suspected meant she was on the scene. In the background, I heard a vast and familiar Mancunian voice demanding to know who Gulid was talking to. DCI Alexander Sewall, who, as SIO, shouldn't even be out of bed until the homicide assessment team had finished their work. "It's Peter," she called back. "He wants to know about our suspicious death."
"Tell him if it's not one of his, he can fuck off," said Sewall.
"Do you have any interest in this?" asked Gulid.
"There may be some related issues," I said, which was sort of true, given that Tyburn's daughter was involved. I heard Gulid pass this on and some grumbled swearing from Sewall.
"Tell him to get his ass down here pronto," he said.
"He wants you to come in,"
said Gulid, and gave me the address. Before I left, I switched off my phone and stepped out the back into the garden. The rain had eased to a misty drizzle that quickly beaded my hair and the leather of my jacket. Beverly's garden is vast by London standards, running 50 meters down to the bank of the river and twice as wide as her neighbor's. Despite the light pollution sullenly reflected off the low cloud, I decided not to risk tripping over the random bits of garden furniture I knew littered the overgrown lawn and conjured a ware light to show me the way. Beverley Brook rises in Worcester Park in southeast London and flows through a ridiculous number of other parks, recreation grounds, and golf courses before joining her mother at Barn Elms. She says that while she averages half a cubic meter of water per second, she's had it up to 6 cubic meters per second a couple of times. And unless she gets some more care, attention, and the occasional bottle of Junipero gin, she's not going to be responsible for where that surplus water's going to end up. Not a threat, you understand, but it's wise not to take a river for granted. Trust me on this. At the end of Beverly's garden is a bank, fringed with young alder and ash striplings, that drops down to the river. For most of its length, Beverley Brook is shallow enough that you can clearly see the stones at the bottom. But here, there was a deep pool overshadowed by a weeping willow. The surface was dark and coldly reflected my milky blue ware light as it bobbed around me in a slow orbit.
"Hey, Bev," I called. "You in there?"
For all I knew, she was kilometers away visiting her mum's place in Wapping, or patrolling the Thames for waifs and suicides, or whatever else it was that she and her sisters spend their time searching for. But she's been known to surface when I've called her name, and once she leapt like a salmon, naked and glistening, into my arms. So it's always worth a try. This time there was no response, just the drizzle and the grumble of the Kingston bypass on the other side of the river. I waited about a minute, just so I could claim I'd waited 5, and then headed back up the garden. I walked out via the side gate past Beverly's Kia Picanto to where the orange Asbo was parked. Once inside, I checked my evidence bag was in the back and that the airwave charger was plugged in, started her up, and headed for Knightsbridge. 1 Hyde Park, squatted next to the Mandarin Oriental Hotel, like a stack of office furniture, and with all the elegance and charm of the inside of a photocopier, albeit a brand new photocopier that doubled as a fax and a document scanner.
Now, I have, as Beverly says, views about architecture. But there's modern stuff I like. The Gherkin, the Lloyd's building, even the Shard, despite the nagging feeling I get that Nazgul should be roosting at the top. But the truth is that in the case of One High Park, my boy Sir Roger was definitely just putting in the hours for the paycheck. It's not ugly as such. It's just not anything in particular. It is famously the most expensive block of flats in Britain, which just goes to show that property really is all about location, location, location. The actual building is comprised of four towers that the brochures call pavilions, running between the Oriental Mandarin Hotel on the east side and the Edinburgh Gate into Hyde Park on the west. The north and south aspects are wedge-shaped to maximize natural daylight. As a result, if you look at a floor plan, it looks like two Star Destroyers have backed into each other during maneuvers. As I approached up the A4, I saw that the lights were out on every floor, except for one flat, halfway up the second tower from the end. So no trouble finding the crime scene, then. Parking was a different matter, but the secret to avoiding a ticket when you're police is to snuggle your reasonably priced unmarked motor in amongst the Battenberg checked IRVs and sprinter vans that accumulate at any crime scene. These I found crowded under the strange concrete canopy that stretches over the Edinburgh Gate. I noticed they also blocked the driveway to where the car lifts waited to whisk the money-mobiles of the rich down to the underground car park. I'd read that the facilities below ground included a private gym, swimming pool, squash court, and wine cellars. I really hope that I didn't have to go down there. It's not that I'm claustrophobic, only that I've had practical experience of just how much the sodding earth can weigh, and the taste despair can leave in your mouth. Gulid was waiting by the cylindrical glass entrance to the lobby. Having worked with me on numerous occasions, she fell on me with cries of glee. "I don't suppose you just consider fucking off," she said. I was shocked. "Language," I said. "Don't you start," she said. I noticed she was wearing a rather fine purple silk hijab with a fringe design, picked out in silver thread, a matching jacket, and an elegant long black skirt. I did not think she planned to be out policing tonight. "Did you have a date?" I asked. "No," she said. "Birthday party. I thought we were in the hat car this week." "I swapped," she said, "so I could go to the birthday party." "Oh," I said. "Sorry. Is this going to be like the thing with the BMWs?" she asked. "I don't know," I said. "I've only just got here." Gulid nodded to the PCSO guarding the entrance. "Put him on the list," she said, and then to me, "You're going to love this place." She led me through the transparent cylindrical airlock-style door, onto a mezzanine balcony, and down a set of stairs into a double-height reception area, with leather chairs and the sort of meaningless sculpture that's bought by the ton by particularly greedy banks. Through transparent walls, rumoured to be bulletproof, I could see a small faux garden, and, through another layer of security glass, the dim and dangerous streets of downtown Knightsbridge. Beside the reception desk stood a fit-looking man with brown skin, black hair, and a good-quality off-the-peg suit. Possibly Indonesian, I thought. He also managed the trick of looking both alert and bored out of his skull at the same time. Ex-job, ex-military, ex-intelligence, something like that. The level of security struck me as a bit paranoid, but as my dad says, the more they have, the more they worry about it being taken away. The security man gave Gulid and me a sour look as we passed, and I responded with a friendly smile and a cheery, "Good morning," because I am an officer of the law, and, providing I'm not nobbled by political considerations and or influence peddling, my arm doth reach into all places, yea, even unto the citadels of the mighty. This particular citadel of the mighty was reached
by a glass-sided lift which ran up a completely transparent service call that allowed one, and one assumes that here one refers to one as one, to appreciate the view over Hyde Park, which, after all, is what one has paid upwards of 10 million to enjoy. The glass elevator led out into a cross passage where we did the dance of the noddy suit, whereby the grave dignity of the law is mitigated by the need to hop on one foot while you try and get the stupid paper leg over the other. Ghulid, it turned out, was wearing leggings under her skirt, which she left, along with her scarf, in the clear plastic bag provided. Once we were safely zipped up in our hygienic, forensically neutral paper suits, Ghulid led me to the left, where a pair of mahogany doors had been propped open with a portable light stand. Beyond was a short hallway with a curved, far wall, and a lot of abstract art on the walls. In home furnishing terms, past a certain point, more money doesn't get you anything except an increase in insurance premiums. An elegantly proportioned room can have whitewashed walls and a bare wooden floor, but if it's an awkward shape, then all the piano-finished rosewood occasional tables riches can provide aren't going to do anything more than annoy the cleaners. One Hyde Park, I saw, had all the basic architectural charm of a brutalist council flat, except on a larger scale. The rooms were much wider, of course, but pressure to maximize the number of flats meant that the ceilings were disproportionately low. We found Seawall just round the corner, in what the plans listed as a study. The architect had laid out each wing to maximize the light, with a long central corridor and side rooms branching off like veins in a leaf. This meant that they all had walls on the diagonal, severely restricting the decorator's choice about where furniture could be placed. If you didn't want to block the doors, the access, or blot out the windows, then the beds, cupboards, shelves, and all the other stuff that turns a concrete box into a home had to go where the architect thought they should go. In the study, this meant a desk that could neither face the window for the view, nor face away to take advantage of the light. Instead, the black mirror-finished desk with the stainless steel legs stood in front of matching glass-fronted bookcases that, as far as I could tell, contained a number of lumpy glass and chrome objects, and a couple of soft porn albums, cunningly disguised as cutting-edge nude photography, still in their shrink wrap, I noticed. Seawall sat in the executive leather operator's chair behind the desk, wearing a dangerously stretched noddy suit that made him look like the Michelin Man's slightly deflated older brother.
"You'll notice you can't swivel all the way round," he said. "What fucking use is a swivel chair if you can't fucking swivel on it?"
He spotted me trying to read the titles on the books.
"Don't bother, they're just window dressing," he said. "As far as we can tell, nobody lives here."
I looked at a framed photograph of a young white woman with a dog. "Who owns this place, then?" I asked.
"Some tax-dodging shell company out of Jersey," said Seawall, running his fingers along the bottom of the desktop, looking for secret drawers, I guessed. "We won't be able to trace that until the lads at Proactive Money Laundering can drag one of their experts out of bed."
He gave up on the idea of the secret drawer and jabbed a finger at Ghulid.
"Sara," he said, "get on the phone and give them a kicking."
"Gladly," said Ghulid, and left.
"Her brother's an accountant," said Seawall, watching her go. "So, what the fuck are you doing here?"
I considered lying for all of about 2 nanoseconds, but I don't have a death wish. Not even a figurative one. Of course, philosophically speaking, truth is a slippery concept, and one should always be alive to nuance. "I got a tip-off from a source that there might be some tangential Falcon involvement," I said. And because I saw Seawall begin to draw himself up, "Lady Cecilia Tyburn-Thames believes her daughter may have been here when the incident occurred."
"And she wants you to put the fix in?"
"Yes."
"Do you know what the incident is?"
"Accidental drug overdose," I said. Seawall nodded.
So I bet you're wondering what the fuck I'm doing here,
he asked. I felt a trickle of sweat work its way down my back.
You wanted a peek into the lifestyles of the rich and shameless, I said.
Because nobody was supposed to have access to this flat, he said. Did you see the DPG cars downstairs?
The Diplomatic Protection Group do bodyguard work for royals, and those people HM government would rather were not done in while resident in the UK. They're routinely armed and drive around in red liveried vehicles. Red, to indicate that they are not there to break up fights, find your toddler, or tell you the bloody time. No, sir, I said.
Really?
Said Seawall.
The lazy buggers must have sloped off for refs.
He explained that, what with the screened entrance, bulletproof quality glass on the lower levels, and the kind of semi-professional security that would gladden the heart of a putative generalissimo, this was the sort of place the DPG knew they could park their high-value targets.
Qatari royal family amongst them, said Seawall.
And then not to have to worry about them until they ventured forth to shop at Harvey Nicks, or go to the opera, or impoverish a small nation, or whatever else it was the very, very rich did when they had time on their hands.
So when a bunch of fucking kids waltz into the building, the DPG wants to know how. And I get woken up in the middle of the fucking night, said Seawall. And told to find out on pain of getting a bollocking. Me? He said in outrage. Getting a bollocking? And just when I thought things couldn't descend further into the brown stuff, here you are.
With a grunt, he levered himself to his feet, causing the chair to bang against the bookcase behind him and set the various objets de bollocks rattling.
See,
he said once he was up.
Not even enough room to lean back and get yourself a bit of light relief. Mind you, there's a media room next door. That would do very nicely for a private viewing room.
He must have seen that I'd lost the thread of his conversation.
Like they used to have in pawn shops, when they were proper pawn shops,
he said slowly, and then shook his head.
I suppose you lot get your mucky pictures uploaded to your phones.
I wondered if he talked like this to Galeed. I doubted it somehow. He led me through to the media room, which was a cool grey-green and lined with sound-absorbing material. There was a vast television, wider than some of the screens I've seen in retrofitted multiplexes, and an elegant curving sofa that actually suited the room it was in. It had also, if I'm any judge, been shagged upon in the last few hours. There was a V-shaped stain in the middle, and the throw cushions, in amethyst and teal covers, had been pushed onto the floor. There was an island of wine bottles in the center of the coffee table, and a pair of wine glasses on the shelf by the Blu-ray player. Both were white with fingerprint dust.
Behold,
said Seawall.
The wank palace itself.
I don't think they were wanking, sir, I said, and Seawall sighed.
You've always got to push it, haven't you, Peter?
He said, and outlined the details of the case. At 12:30, a 999 call had been made by a young man from a mobile phone asking for an ambulance and claiming that his friend Chrissy was having an overdose and needed help. He was
hysterical, desperate, and, said Seawall, obviously out of his box.
But when the ambulance arrived, security wouldn't let them into the building, claiming that the flat was unoccupied. The ambulance crew reported it to CCC, who sent an instant response vehicle around, which ran straight into a pair of DPG officers, responding because the building alarm was set up to inform them directly. Everyone piled up in the lifts, security opened the flat door, and voila. They found Christina Chorley, aged 17, lying in the entrance hall in the midst of a seizure. She had been dragged there by her boyfriend James Murray, also 17. James told the paramedics and everybody else in the immediate vicinity that it was just ease, it was just ease. Had he taken them? Yes, he had. Who else was in the flat? It was just them. Oh God, it was just ease. Off in the ambulance went the pair of them,
while both sets of police kicked their problem upstairs until it bounced off DCI Seawall's bedroom window.
Metaphorically speaking,
said Seawall. The entrance hall was the wide, wedge-shaped, low-ceilinged room with an unparalleled view over Hyde Park. I was getting used to the sheer amount of money wasted on the furniture, which was spread out like something designed for The Sims. In amongst the money, there were signs that people had been having a good time. More bottles, wine glasses, empty cellophane packets, a flat pool of oatmeal-coloured vomit on the carefully chosen hand-woven cream wool rug. Definitely more than two people. At least six or seven, I thought. Maybe more if they were particularly tidy teams. Not so tidy that they didn't leave their pills behind when they scrambled to get out.
We think they left as soon as James Morey made his 999 call,
said Seawall. Both the police and the paramedics entered a description of the pills into the Tic Tac database and got a name. Magic Bar Bars. And the worrying information that this particular brand tended to be heavy on the PMA, otherwise known as paramethoxyamphetamine, or Dr. Death. Not MDMA, otherwise known as ecstasy, otherwise known as the drug that allows you to listen to really dull music without your brain imploding from boredom. Seriously, PMA is a lot more toxic than MDMA and kicks in slower, so users have been known to swallow another couple of pills, thinking the first were duds, and then suffer what Dr. Walid would describe as deleterious effects. Given that Christina Chorley had died on the way to the hospital, it was important to find out who else had taken the magic bar bars in case they needed treatment, and to find out quickly, before James Murray keeled over himself. At first, James had tried to claim that he and Christina had been alone in the flat. But 5 minutes with D.I. Stephanopoulos, who, having been pulled untimely from her wife's embrace, was particularly pissed off that morning, saw him coughing names as fast as they could be written down.
Amongst them was the name Olivia Jane McAllister Thames, said Seawall. Now I've got a few questions that need answering. Like, how did they get in? Where did the drugs come from? And can I get a result before the case turns into a great big fucking media shitstorm?
I joined him at the window. It was getting light, and the thick mist was washing out the trees and pastures of Hyde Park and the city beyond. Seawall pointed down to a pair of statues in the faux garden at the back of the estate. Two bronze heads that looked like they'd been flattened in a Corby trouser press and then had their brains scooped out.
It's called Waiting for Enlightenment, said Seawall,
looking at the statues.
But if you ask me, it's a fucking rip-off of the Foothills of the Headlands from Yellow Submarine,
which meant nothing to me.
God, money is so wasted on the rich.
Do you want me to statement Olivia McAllister Thames? I asked.
No, he said. I want Sarah to do that.
He waved airily back at the flat.
Have you had a chance to check for any tingles?
I said with some dignity that I had done an initial Falcon assessment and found nothing that indicated that a supernatural event had taken place on the premises.
Thank Christ for that, said Seawall. In that case, you can go with Gulid and make sure nothing weird happens to her.
Seawall, like most of the senior officers who were aware of the folly, might not like me using the M-word. But they weren't about to ignore anything that might have an impact at an operational level. It's understandable. You may not want to dwell on the fact that 80% of infant homicides are committed by the parents, but you're still going to make the grieving mum and dad your prime suspects until proved otherwise.
In fact,
he said,
I'm making you personally fucking responsible for making sure nothing weird happens to her. If you can't guarantee that, I want your boss down here to do the job instead, understand?
Yes, Garth, I said. Gulid always claimed that she joined the police on a dare. My sister bet me I wouldn't send off the application, she told me, when we'd been doing the thing with the haunted BMWs. But I didn't think I'd be accepted. When I'd asked about the mandatory interview, she said she had nothing better to do that day, What did your parents think? I said. They thought the starting salary was a bit on the low side. What about your friends? I asked. And Galida changed the subject. Galida was one of Sewald's favoured few, one of his Valkyries, and he was determined to push her up the fast track, sending her off to handle a tricky interview, like the one with Olivia McAllister Thames, was part test, part toughening exercise, and part vote of confidence. Tyburn lived a kilometre east of One Hyde Park, just off the Shepherd's Market, in a five-storey Georgian terrace whose elegant proportions would have caused the most hardened Canadian property developer's soul to weep to see such beauty. Just prior to having the place gutted and filled with the latest in personality-free interior design. I couldn't see Tyburn doing that. She wanted the connection with the past, with the old institutions and traditions of the city. She saw it as her birthright. I rang the doorbell, and as we waited, me and Galida intoned the Londoner's lament.
Look at this place, said Galida.
I know.
How much do you reckon?
8 million, I said, last time I looked.
All right for some,
said Galida. To which my ritual response would have been, isn't it just? But right then, the front door opened and Lady Ty stood there, looking at us as if we'd turned up with some colourful pamphlets and an evangelical zeal to get her to change her energy supplier. I let Galida do all the talking. I'm good that way with my colleagues. When Lady Ty led us into the kitchen, Olivia wrinkled her nose and shot an inquiring look at her mother, who cut her off with a glare. Olivia McAllister Thames was pale, much lighter than me, with brown hair that fell into the sort of natural ringlets that my mum would have sacrificed her firstborn to possess. She retained her mother's eyes, though, a deep brown colour and pinked up at the corners like a cat's. She wore an oversized amber rugby jersey that fell almost to her knees, jeans, and purple flip-flops. Sitting next to Olivia was a white, middle-aged man who Lady Ty introduced as her solicitor. He got up politely as we entered and shook our hands. Olivia did not. We all sat down at the kitchen table. Outside London, modern policing leans towards table-free interviews on the basis that it's easier to read someone's body language and record it on CCTV if there isn't a cigarette-scarred stretch of laminated chipboard in the way. I wondered if Lady Ty knew that, which was why we weren't doing this in the living room, or if she just didn't want me rifling through her Blu-ray collection. Galida passed me a statement form, so I had to hunt around in my pockets for a decent pen. Most statements are taken by hand, and it pays to be picky about your writing implements and cultivate an easy-flowing style. I use a Mitsubishi Uniball, in case you were wondering. We started with caution plus two, which involves us scaring the interviewee to death with the normal caution. You do not have to say anything, etc., etc. And then, right when they're sure we're going to march them off to the cells, we throw in, but you're not under arrest at this time and are free to leave if you want to, at the end. The solicitor nodded sagely as Galida reeled it off. Olivia stared at the table, and Lady Ty gave me a sour smile at free to leave. Galida warmed up by asking where Olivia went to school. St. Paul's, which was a hideously expensive private school in Hammersmith. Although, because she was a day student, it probably only cost the equivalent of a police constable's starting salary. She was hoping to go to Cambridge, but first there was the gap year. Olivia pronounced it gap year, when she planned to do good somewhere in the third world. Teaching English, she said, or building orphanages. I haven't decided which. Somalia, perhaps, said Lady Ty, and then to me, or Sierra Leone. Mrs. Thames, said Galida, I'd be grateful if you could allow your daughter to answer the questions on her own. I saw a flash of anger in Lady Ty's face, followed by a hint of amusement and respect. Galida asked where Olivia lived, whether this was her only address and other questions she already knew the answers to, but which allowed her to circle around to where Olivia had been last night. I clocked the brief. He looked a bit complacent to me, but there was a sheen of sweat on his lip. Family solicitor, I decided. More used to conveyancing and moving Lady Ty's wealth around than to police interviews. "Was your mum here last night?" asked Galeed. Olivia hesitated and her eyes flicked towards her mum, who stared fixedly at Galeed.
"Yes," said Olivia, "as far as I know." "Was your father home too?" asked Galeed. "He's out of the country," said Lady Ty.
Galeed asked where he might be.
"Is this relevant?" asked the lawyer. "Just establishing a timeline," said Galeed. "He's in Dubai," said Lady Ty, "on a contract." "Really?" said Galeed. "What kind of contract?" "He's a civil engineer," said Lady Ty, and then, staring directly at me, said, "He specializes in hydrology, water management systems, that sort of thing."
She looked back to Galeed.
"He's the top man in his field."
Me and Galeed knew all of this, of course, because not only had we asked for an IIP check before we'd arrived, and not only do I, as a matter of routine, keep dossiers on all the rivers these days, but also because Beverly had got pissed a couple of weeks previously and spent all night bending my ear about Lady Ty and her perfect bloody husband. According to Bev, there were only two things that could improve George McAllister Thames in her mum's eyes. One was a medical degree, and the other was a bit more of a suntan.
"And what do you do?"
asked Galeed.
"Detective,"
said the lawyer, staring at her.
"Really?" "I'm curious," said Galeed. "Hasn't the Starling told you?" asked Lady Ty. "The Starling?"
Lady Ty tilted her head in my direction.
"Your colleague," she said. "She sits on a bunch of quangos,"
said Olivia, staring at a point on the table midway between us,
"and is a director on, like, a gazillion boards."
"Five," said Lady Ty. "I'm non-executive director for 5 firms."
"So, not the goddess of the River Tyburn, then?"
asked Galeed.
I winced, and Olivia rolled her eyes, but fortunately, Lady Ty was in a whimsical mood.
"That's not precisely a job, now, is it?" she asked. "And rather beside the point."
The lawyer opened his mouth to speak, but Galeed quickly turned to Olivia and asked how many people had been in the flat.
"Don't know,"
said Olivia.
"I see," said Galeed. "Why don't we start with the people you do know were there?"
Olivia squirmed in her seat like a 5-year-old. This is why your brief tells you to keep your mouth shut during an interview. She made Galeed work for it, but in the end, she confirmed that she, along with several others, had been in the flat. She hadn't known the dead girl, Christina Chorley, and she didn't know how the party had gained access to One Hyde Park.
"We went through the hotel next door," she said.
The Mandarin Oriental Hotel provided a complete package of services for the denizens of One Hyde Park, ranging from cleaning and catering to dog walking and aromatherapy, and there was an underground tunnel from the hotel to the estate. From there, the kids travelled up the segregated service corps and into the flat.
"I was just following everyone else," she said, and claimed to have been a bit squiffy.
One of the guys might have known the codes to the security doors. She thought his name was James, but she didn't know his surname. So it could have been James Murray, the unfortunate Christina's boyfriend. But you can't afford to make assumptions like that. She did know the names of Albertina Price, a fellow student at St. Paul's, and her boyfriend, Alastair somebody or other, who was at Westminster. Maureen, who was someone's older sister, and Rod, whatever that was short for, Crawfish or something like that. Definitely Scottish.
"He had one of those posh Scottish accents," said Olivia.
Galeed circled around the names and timeline for 20 minutes, 20 minutes being about the amount of time it takes your average suspect, sorry, I mean witness, to forget the details of the lies they've just told you, before asking about the drugs.
"What drugs?"
asked Olivia.
her eyes flicking towards the walnut reproduction French farmhouse cupboard with, I was pleased to note, one shelf that displayed a 1977 Jubilee commemoration plate, along with two more plates with photographs custom printed on them. One each for Olivia and her brother, from at least 3 years ago. Judging by the pained expressions, formal pose and school uniforms, they'd been reproduced from school photographs. My mum has a shelf like that in the living room with, amongst others, a Lady Diana commemorative plate set and my Hendon graduation photo. "These," said Galid, and showed Olivia a picture on her tablet. A spray of small pink pills lay across a sheet of white paper. Each one was marked with a smiling elephant's head. Magic bar bars. Olivia glanced at the picture, then sideways at her mother, and I saw her make the wrong decision. But before I could say anything, she opened her mouth and stuck her future in it.
"Yeah, I bought those," she said. "What about it?"
Chapter 2. Teenage Kicks. Galid had to arrest her. She had no choice. The brief knew it too, but before he could get his mouth open, Galid was on her feet and doing the caution. Lady Tai, who had been staring disbelievingly at her daughter, snapped her head around to look at Galid. And there was an expression I never thought to see on her face. Abject fear. It was gone in an instant, replaced by a look of calm determination, which is a signal for any sensible son of West Africa that it is way past time to be vacating the area. She stood up, and as she did, I felt a sudden drag, as if I'd been caught in an icy undertow. I swear the mugs on the drying rack by the sink started to rattle. I followed her up and said her name as loudly and as forcefully as I dared. "Tyburn." She glared at me, and then down at her daughter, who was looking up at all the grown-ups, with a shocked expression that showed that only now, at the end, did she understand the sheer depth of the shit she'd just dropped herself in. Looking back, I reckon the only reason it didn't all go pear-shaped right there, in the kitchen, was because Lady Tai couldn't figure out which one of us she was more pissed off with.
"Why don't we all sit down," said Galid, "while I arrange some transportation?"
Me and Tyburn took our seats, but I noticed Galid fade out the kitchen door, the better to demand shitloads of backup. We were going to need transportation back to Belgravia, a search team for the house, plus, please God, some Falcon backup for me, and a senior officer to throw the warm, comforting blanket of rank over the whole proceedings.
"Am I really under arrest?" asked Olivia.
The brief cleared his throat.
"You," said Lady Tai to her daughter. "Not one more word. You," she said to the solicitor. "I want the best criminal solicitor you know waiting for us at the police station when we get there."
The solicitor gulped, bobbed his head, and opened his mouth to speak before thinking better of it. Pausing only to gather up his briefcase and papers, he made a speedy exit from the kitchen.
"I," said Olivia. "Shut up, you stupid little girl," said Tyburn.
And so we sat in silence for the 10 minutes it took Galid to rustle up some official transport, whereupon she returned to the kitchen and told Olivia that she would have to accompany her to the station. We all stood up again, but this time Lady Tai had herself under control, and she watched her daughter being led away without any major property damage, although I did make a mental note to check with Thames Water that afternoon, just in case.
"Is this your idea of three bags full?"
she said, once we were alone. "I should have left you under the ground." And it was while I'd been underground that I'd had what I thought at the time was a hallucination. A waking dream that I'd stood on the Oxford Road when it was a ribbon of dust through the countryside and talked to a young man with a sword at his hip and a gleam in his eye. The locals called him Sir William,
and he wanted me to stay and have a chat, but I had business in the land of the living. When I was done with that, I enlisted the help of the Follies' official archivist, Dr. Harold Postmartin, to see what the histories said. We tracked down a reference to him in the Rotuli Parliamentorum, which, as any fool know, is all in Latin. He was listed as Sir William of Tyburn, although the translation could have been read as of the Tyburn. I'd have liked to ask Lady Ty whether our young Sir William had been an earlier incarnation of the Tyburn, and did she have any memory of him or sense of continuity, or was there a total break when he died in the mid-19th century? But it's a wise man who knows when to keep his gob shut. And so we spent what felt like a really long time in silence, until finally Lady Ty's head jerked round to face the front of the house. "Well, that's you off the hook," she said. "Your lord and master has arrived." A couple moments later, Nightingale opened the kitchen door and stepped in. He gave Lady Ty a formal little nod.
"Cecilia," he said, "how are you holding up?"
"Oh, I'm just gratified to be getting the personal touch," she said.
"Why don't you come with me," said Nightingale, "and we'll see if we can sort this out."
It's what you say, even to people standing over the bleeding body of their significant other with a claw hammer in their hand. And the weird thing is that most people, even the ones that have got to know that whatever happens, it isn't going to end well for them, come along quietly and let themselves be sorted out. I didn't think that Lady Ty was going to stay quiet indefinitely, but sometimes that's the joy of being a lowly constable. You get to foist your problems onto your elders and betters. Before he left the kitchen, Nightingale caught my eye and gestured upwards. He wanted me to check Olivia's bedroom before the main search team got there. The problem with forensics is that the better it gets, the more inconvenient it is to work around. In the old days, the police could get away with clomping around in their size 12s and poking things with a pencil. Now, they can pull a viable DNA result off a sample the size of a ladybird's eyeball, and you've got to be wearing gloves at the very least. I used to walk around with a spare pair of gloves in my pocket, but now I've got a set of booties in there as well, just to be on the safe side.
You got to watch those booties when walking on polished wood, though.
So I left them off until I'd located Olivia's room on the second floor. It was a big room, expensively wallpapered in a subtle blue and lavender pattern, with reconditioned sash windows that looked out over the street. The high ceiling had its original plaster mouldings, and it was, if you threw in the ensuite bathroom, about two-thirds the size of my parents' flat. Her walk-in wardrobe was easily the size of my old bedroom, and totally wasted because, as far as I could tell, the bulk of Olivia's clothes was spread out in a nice, even layer across the floor. I stooped to check some of the labels, mostly high-end high street with a couple of designer bits. In contrast, her shoes were neatly ranked on a set of purpose-built shelves at the foot of the bed. Some of the heels were a bit outrageous, especially a pair of blue Manolo Blahnik pumps that looked like an invitation to ankle damage to me. There was no way Lady Ty didn't have a cleaner, and judging from the absence of dust in the gaps between the banisters, he or she was coming in at least 4 days a week. Still, I doubted that our hypothetical cleaner had been in early enough that morning to change the linen on the neatly made bed. I looked closer. There was a dent in the coverlet, and the pillows had been scrunched up. My guess was that Olivia had come back and slept on top of her bed, briefly, before me and Ghulid had arrived to brighten up her day. She'd been casually dressed and freshly laundered when we'd interviewed her, which meant she must have showered and changed. I checked the ensuite bathroom, and there, on the floor, was last night's party gear and her bath towel. I kept my distance and made a note to inform the follow-up search team so they could bag them up. I stepped back into the bedroom and tried to get a feel for Olivia. There was a poster of Joan Armour Trading facing the bed. It was a blow-up of her 1976 album cover, custom-framed and hung with care. It seemed a bit retro for Olivia. I mean, I only knew about Joan because she was one of the few non-jazz LPs that my dad had allowed in his collection, alongside Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, and a few very early Jethro Tulls. I'd played the shit out of it when my dad wasn't home until I'd got old enough to bootleg my own taste in music. Next to Joan was a photo montage sprawled across the meter or so of wall between the poster and the wardrobe door. Most of the pictures were inkjet hard copies on standard gauge printing paper and pasted to the wall with Evo stick, but some had obviously been cut from magazines, fashion magazines, judging by the glossy quality of the paper. I recognized Alec Weck, Azalea Banks, and a smattering of white pop stars and actors. The other photos were phone snaps, mostly selfies. Olivia at parties, clubs, and school. Olivia out and about in London. I got out my phone and took reference pictures of all the people featured in the snaps and made a rough note of how many times they appeared. One white girl was the out-and-out favorite. Wide-set blue eyes, a mass of curly black hair that either flopped untidily over her face or was pulled back into a variety of pigtails, bunches, and in one instance, elaborately piled up on her head. The latter saw her and Olivia posing in formal dresses outside somewhere gilt-edged and posh-looking. They had their arms comfortably wrapped around each other's waists and were grinning mischievously at the camera. Best friends forever, I decided. None of the other boys and girls turned up with anything like the same frequency, and all, with the exception of one snap with her brother and another of her mother, were white. On top of her sturdy work desk, textbooks and folders were arranged with obsessive neatness. English, geography and French. I flicked through them, looking for hidden notes. But all I found was post-it notes and a lot of color-coded highlighter pen. One thing was for certain. Olivia had no intention of failing her A-levels. With what her mum was like, I didn't blame her. Her bookshelves were interesting, pre-teen, at the bottom, mixed in with a couple of board games. Older books above them, Roald Dahl, Diary of a Wimpy Kid and Harry Potter, graduating up to Twilight, The Girl's Book of Excellence, Mallory Blackman, and, surprisingly, Zola's Le Ventre de Paris in the original French. Because it stuck out, I opened it up and found it was full of penciled notes in the margin, mostly English translations of difficult words. My French is actually worse than my Latin, but even I could tell that this was advanced stuff for an A-level student. I went back to the collage and looked again. Judging by the design of the frontage they were posing before, the picture of Olivia and her BFF in formal dress could well have been taken in a French city. A couple of others definitely had Beaux-Arts architecture in the background. Possibly France again. If I'd been standing in anything but a multi-million Mayfair terrace, I might have been thinking of possible importation routes. But rich kids don't need to hoof drugs over the border themselves. The rich have people for that sort of thing. And disposable people at that. There were two main sockets in the room, both with their own tangle of chargers and extension cords, and I spent a couple of minutes matching them to her laptop, printer, her high-end play bar, one spare for an iPhone that I suspected even now was being placed in front of the custody sergeant at Belgravia Nick, and another spare that might have been for a different brand of phone. I made a note to check what Olivia carried, and whether it or a second phone had been handed in. A black lacquered wooden tray on the desk held paper clips, a post-it pad, and scatter of USB sticks. Those I decided to leave for the technical forensics guys from Newlands Park. I sat on the bed, took a deep breath, and closed my eyes. I hadn't found any controlled substances or drug paraphernalia. It might have been hidden away, but if it was, the follow-up Pulsar team would find it. I couldn't feel any vestigia in the room either. I'd always felt something with the various gods and goddesses of the rivers, even when they were reining it back on purpose. But there was nothing here, apart from the usual background. What did the child of a river and a mortal inherit, and from whom? Fleet was married to a fae, but Beverly said all her children were adopted.
Oxley had Isis, who obviously caught longevity from somewhere. And Ephra had Oberon, who Nightingale called an old soldier. Note the capital letters. And if I had kids with Beverly, not that kids were on the table, what would they be like? Apart from staggeringly good-looking, of course. Would they be rivulets, streams, storm drains, or just ordinary? Which reminded me to phone Beverly. "Hi, babes," she said. In the background, I could hear water slapping against the vertical surface, the hull of a boat, or more likely, a piling of some sort. I asked her where she was.
"Up at Eel Pie Island," she said, "sorting out a dispute. These people are cheeky, you know. They think buying a house on an island is just another investment opportunity."
"Isn't it?" I asked. That end of Richmond stroke Twickenham had become hipster central since the big money had started pushing all the TV producers and literary editors out of Hampstead and Primrose Hill.
"Nah," she said. "Live on an island in the middle of a river, especially this river, you gotta put out some signs and favours if you want to prosper. You still at my house?"
"I'm on a shout," I said. Obviously Beverly hadn't heard about her niece yet.
"Pity," she said. "I was hoping you'd be keeping the bed warm for me."
"Sorry," I said. "Listen, the job I'm on, I can't say anything right now, but you need to contact your mum."
"Is this like a job-job," asked Beverly, "or a magic job-job?"
"I don't know, and I'm not supposed to tell you anyway," I said.
"You might be able to tell yourself later," said Beverly. "She says she might be turning up for your dad's gig."
Which I'd forgotten about. "Just call your mum," I said. "It's important." Beverly promised she would, just as soon as she'd sorted out some recalcitrant islanders. And our kids would be, I thought, after we'd hung up. Good at swimming? I wasn't going to learn anything more in this room. It was time to hit the factory floor. What with the jazz thing, the underground thing, the business with the haunted car, the Russians, and let's not forget the mold, however hard we tried to, Belgravia MIT had bowed to the inevitable and given me my own desk in the outside inquiry office. I say my own desk, but actually I shared it with Gulid and a white DC called David Carey. Neither of them were that happy with the arrangement, not least because it was a two-person desk. "Oh, it's going to be one of those jobs," said Carey when I settled in beside him. "Is it too late to put in for holiday?" I told him it was, but if he was lucky, Gulid would do all the heavy lifting. "So long as I don't have to deal with any more weird cars," he said. The job had acquired an operational name, Marigold, and a quick call to the case manager in the inside inquiry office got me access to Holmes. I entered the results of my preliminary search of Olivia's bedroom and downloaded the pictures I'd taken of the collage on the wall. Then I went hunting to see if anyone had developed a definitive list of the kids who'd been at the party, to see if I could match them up. I did that until Carey pointed out that the current list was on the whiteboard, along with photos. I matched up Albertina Price to one of the pictures in Olivia's collage, but none of the others. I asked Carey whether this was the confirmed party list, but he said they were still waiting on statements. Down the corridor, in an interview room, Olivia, now sitting next to a solicitor with a properly expensive suit and a suitably belligerent Scouse accent, had sensibly decided to keep her mouth shut. Gulid was pissed off, because not only had the preliminary search of the Tyburns' house not turned up anything useful, but of the six separate sets of prints lifted from the pill packets, none matched Olivia's. Nor, in fact, had any of the prints recovered from the flat at One High Park. Gulid wanted to know if Tyburn could magic away fingerprints, but I said probably not without wiping everything else. She asked me to check with Nightingale, and I said I was sure, because I made a point of coming up with a list of modern forensic techniques, and then going through them one by one to see if Nightingale could counter them.
"Did anything work?"
asked Gulid.
"So far nothing," I said. "You can burn the top surfaces off a scene, but it's pretty obvious that you've done it."
"I can imagine," said Gulid, who'd once seen me roast a duck by accident. Since Olivia was 17, she was allowed an adult to remain with her, as well as her solicitor. Naturally, she chose her mum, which meant that, for safety's sake, Nightingale had to be in the interview room too. Given the circumstances, D.I. Stephanopoulos